Turn with me to Daniel chapter 8, and then allow me to spend just a few minutes considering what I wrote on the wipe-off board here. Daniel chapter 8. Find your spot there. Now, let's compare what we've studied so far. Now, we know that in Daniel chapter 1, we have Daniel and his three buddies are finally apprehended in the first invasion under Nebuchadnezzar around 606, 605 BC. And since Nebuchadnezzar only took the cream of the crop and he took members of the royal family, then it stands to reason that Daniel and his three friends were members of the royal family. It's a possibility that Daniel could have been related to David and in turn Christ, because he was of the royal family, and that's whom Nebuchadnezzar apprehends and takes back to Babylon. Then he puts him in that three-year study program. Then in chapter 3 of Daniel, we have the three Hebrew boys contending with the statue that Nebuchadnezzar erects to himself and to the state. And many commentators believe that the statue in his dream in chapter 2, that Nebuchadnezzar mimics that metallic man in chapter 3, making that gold-plated hollow statue representing himself and the state, and then mixing music and religion to force all people to bow down, not only to him as a deity, but also to the power and the authority of the state. And then in Daniel chapter 4, we had his dream about the tree, which represented him. Daniel 5, we have the final king of Babylon, the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, with that unique handwriting on the wall. Then in chapters 6 and 7, we had Daniel in the lion's den. Okay, so those chapters there do not have a whole bunch of prophecy that is long range as Daniel 2, 7, and 8, okay, and then the rest of the book of Daniel. But I want to show you this, putting this on the board, let's kind of compare and see where these dots begin to be connected. For instance, in Daniel chapter 2, with that metallic man, you have the gold head that represents Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. You have the silver chest and the two arms of silver representing the Medes and the Persians. The brass waist area, the torso area, would be Greece. And then you have the two legs of iron, which represents ancient Rome. And then the feet are made of clay and iron mixed together, which shows that there wasn't really a tight bond. And then there was this huge rock uncut by human hands that's hurled in the days of those kings, and that entire metallic man comes down in a mighty crash. And then that rock cut not by human hands, expands and becomes a kingdom. So there's that first vision, that's that first dream that looks down the road. And as I mentioned in other lessons, my contention is that these empires would follow one after the other. There would not be huge time gaps of hundreds, if not thousands, of years between them. The other assertion that I'm contending is that all of these nations played a part in Israel's history, either as a chastening rod, or allowing them to go back and to rebuild their city and to rebuild their temple, or giving them a universal language that would form the basis of the New Testament. And then you come to the Roman Empire, and due to the decree of one Caesar, a unique prophecy on where the Messiah would be born could have been fulfilled. And so once these four empires are gone, my assertion, my contention, is that there's nothing that's going to come after them down the future. Like even in our future reference point, there isn't going to be a fifth and a sixth empire, even from our vantage point. I believe all of these empires and all of the history that these represent were going to find their termination with the inauguration of the new covenant. Now notice Daniel 7. Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 2 sees a metallic man. He sees himself as only man would see himself. In Daniel chapter 7, God shows the same empires only from a heavenly divine viewpoint as nothing more but carnivorous, bloodthirsty beasts or animals. Here, Nebuchadnezzar or Babylon is represented by a two-winged lion that's given a man's heart. Now, the man's heart here, This would refer back to Daniel 4 and his conversion. That's what I believe, the fact that the lion was given a man's heart and the lion was told to stand tall as a man. That would be, to me, a reference, a point of reference to his conversion, which would throw you back to Daniel 4. Then the bear leaning on one side with three ribs in its mouth would correspond with the Persians. Again, this is heaven's assessment of the same name, the same empires that Nebuchadnezzar sees in his metallic man. The leopard with the four wings, the speed of the leopard, the fastness of the leopard, representing Alexander the Great. Okay? And then the four wings represent the fact that when Alexander died, his empire would be divided by four of his generals because he did not have a son to take over. Then the fourth and final beast was this horrible beast with teeth of iron that stamped everything into the ground and chewed up everything that came before it. And then this particular beast has 10 horns, representing 10 kings. And then we also studied in Daniel 7 that there was going to be an 11th horn coming up, and he would come up, or by coming up, he would ouster the three previous kings before him. And then we looked at that list of Roman Caesars and come to find out that if the history works itself out correctly, as we try to understand this, that would be Emperor Vespasian, whose son Titus would be the one to bring the walls of Jerusalem down. Also in Daniel 7, you're introduced to something that would go back to this mountain, this rock uncut by human hands, that becomes a kingdom. Well, this corresponds in Daniel 7 to the Son of Man ascending up to the Ancient of Days to receive that kingdom. Okay? And then we see the sons of the kingdom, the Christians, taking over that kingdom and then advancing that kingdom. Now you come to Daniel 8, and notice what you're going to find. Now in Daniel 8, you are going to get a front row interpretation of Daniel 8, more so than what was given in 2 or 7. This is going to be quite an interesting chapter. Now, the Bible is going to define to us with perfect clarity who these two animals represent. We will not get to the interpretation tonight, but simply the vision itself. That's my desire. Here tonight, we're going to see a ram. And the ram has two horns, one of which is longer than the other. And this ram is going in all different directions, conquering. Then out of the west, so you have to have a map in your mind, whoever this animal represents, you got to think, okay, if this animal is empire whatever, then you got to go look to the west to find out who the he-goat is, a male goat. This male goat has one notable horn, and he moves so fast and so swift, the Bible says that he doesn't even touch the ground. He just comes out of the west flying. Doesn't even touch the ground. That's how fast he's going. And he's going to duke it out with the ram with the two horns. And just when the he-goat would reach the apex of his power, he's terminated. And in his place, four horns will arise. And then, out of one of these horns, we're going to come to another little horn. In chapter 7, we're introduced to a little horn, Vespasian. Chapter 8, you were introduced to a little horn. And if you're a futurist, you're going to identify the little horn of chapter 8 as the future Antichrist. If you are not a futurist, you're going to identify this horn with another king that we shall study. So does that kind of whet your appetite? Who in the world could these be? Now, as smart as you are, you should be able to look at that. And the way I was describing, you should be able to draw the line. What two empires Daniel 8 focuses in. I will tell you that these two animals represent two of the ones represented in chapter 2 and 7. Okay, they represent two out of the four. All right? Now notice the timeline. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, Now flip over quickly to chapter 7, verse 1. Notice Daniel 7 is in the very first year of Belshazzar, which some say was around 555 BC, 555 BC. Well, if you do the math, chapter 8, you're either going to be 552 or 553 BC. So, apparently, Daniel 8 comes within a short amount of time after Daniel 7. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me Daniel. Now notice this. After that which appeared unto me at the first. Underline that phrase. After that which appeared unto me at the first. And off to the side, put down 7:1. Chapter 7, verse 1. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace. Now notice how much detail is given. Time, place, how, and when. I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was in Shushan in the palace. Another name for Shushan would be Susa, S-U-S-A. In the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ule. Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram, notice, pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will, and became great. So notice how this ram is pushing in three different directions. He has two horns. The larger of the two comes up last. Now this should all be making sense in light of chapters 2 and 7. Okay? Verse 5. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat, or in the Hebrew, a male goat, came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and notice, touch not the ground. Meaning his feet didn't even gallop. I mean, there wasn't even a stride. He just kind of like springs into history. Touch not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Notice, one notable, outstanding horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was move or collier against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. So this ram eventually is unable to stand before this he-goat. But the he-goat cast him down to the ground, stamped upon him. And notice this, there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. So this ram could not even appeal to any of his allies. Any other nation at that time was unable to render aid. He was at the mercy of the he-goat. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, notice, when he was strong, when he was at the pinnacle, the great horn was broken, that one notable horn broken. For it came up four noticeable ones towards the four winds of heaven. Now notice, you don't find the word horns mentioned in that last phrase, but it's implied. One notable horn now becomes four separate horns. And out of the one of them came forth, underline, a little horn. And there's two major schools of interpretation of who the little horn is, which waxed exceeding great toward the south, towards the east, and towards the pleasant land. Now notice, since north is not mentioned, he pushes to the south, which means his point of origin is to the north, number one, and the pleasant land refers to Israel. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Now, if we're going to be literal, does verses 10 imply that this man was able to reach up and take the North Star and drag it down to Earth? We've already seen how stars, sun, and moon, when used in apocalyptic language, which this is a prime example of apocalyptic language, represents governmental powers. Those who believe that they're never going to fall are going to fall. And so this individual here, he's going to bring down other monarchs and other leaders. This has nothing to do with him wrestling with the stars of heaven. Verse 11, yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him, now get this, the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Well, this refers to the temple. The daily sacrifice that was offered by the Jews, as prescribed by Moses, whoever this little horn is, forces the Jews to cease their true worship of the true and living God. So, since it talks about a sanctuary, if you're a futurist, then you would have to imply that this is a third rebuilt temple during the tribulational period. And this is the Antichrist who's going around changing things on God's people in the middle of the 7 years. Because the first 3 years, the first 3.5 years of the tribulation, Mr. Antichrist and the Jews are in the same bed. At the midway point, according to the futurist scheme, he does a 180 and he begins to assault God's people and the temple. So if you're a futurist, verse 11 is yet to be. If you're not a futurist, then you got to take the position, this has to have been fulfilled. The question is, when, why, how, and by whom? Verse 12. And a host was given him against a daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Now you got to admit, verses 12 seems to be very difficult to decipher. Okay? Well, that's as far as we're going to go tonight, because in verses 13, he's going to get help, as he did in chapter 7, on trying to unravel what this means. Okay? Brethren, let's go ahead and jump in the pool here. As we move into chapter 8, we come to an interesting vision given to Daniel about two symbolic animals. Each animal represents an empire still in Daniel's future when the vision is given, when it was given to him. In this next vision, another little horn is revealed to the prophet, who would unleash a destructive blow to God's people many years prior to Messiah's coming. I'm taking the position that the little horn that's mentioned in verses 10 and 11 has already been a historical figure. The question is, how can we identify who that individual is? However, the heady, Daniel first sees a two-horned ram, followed by a lone horn male goat, who enters into this mortal combat against the ram. However, the heady high-minded he-goat, while reaching the apex of his power and his dominion, is quickly cut down, and he in turn is divided into four horns. So what does this all mean? Well, let's get the setting. Look at chapter 8, verse 1. We're told that this is given to Daniel. Now, remember, Belshazzar is Babylonian. Now, this is in his third year. Belshazzar is going to rule for a little while, along with his daddy, Nabonidus, before the Persians come in and destroys everything, as is recorded way back in Daniel 5. So Babylon is still on the table. Persia, Greece, and ancient Rome is not even in the picture yet. So this was given during the time of Babylon, with the last ruling king for that empire. All right. So this is either going to be 553 or 552 BC. Okay. Now, linguistic content. Let me show you something. You don't pick this up in your English translation. But for those of you who may not know, starting in Daniel chapter 2, verse 4, all the way to Daniel 7, 28, the end of chapter 7, that portion of the book of Daniel is not written in Hebrew. It's Aramaic. All that in Daniel, picking up at verse 4 of chapter 2, what we know to be chapter 4, verse 4 of chapter 2, all the way to the end of 7 is Aramaic. Now, when you pick up and look at 8:1 to the rest of the book, it goes back to Hebrew. It goes all the way back to Hebrew. I thought maybe you guys would like to know that little linguistic fact. Okay? So in chapter 8, the Hebrew resumes. Daniel informs us here that this vision followed his first vision as recorded in chapter 7. Look at verse 1 of chapter 8 again. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel. Notice, after that which appeared unto me at the first. So this follows 3 years, time-wise, after chapter 7. Now, notice the geographical context. Okay, look at verse 2. I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ule. So you have some geographical points here. For those of you taking notes, Shushan was Babylon's royal palace. And it would eventually become the royal palace for the Persians when they took over. But Shushan is also known by another name, Susa, S-U-S-A. Now hold your place here and turn to the book of Esther. And notice the same palace is mentioned there as well. Look at Esther chapter 1 and notice the context. Look at verse 1, Esther 1:1. It came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces, that in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace. So notice, Shushan the palace is mentioned while under Babylonian dominance. Well, apparently when the Persians came in, they didn't wipe this palace off the map. They just simply took it over. So now we have Persia. Esther lives under Persia dominance. And notice the same palace, Shushan, is mentioned after the events of Daniel 8. Only this time it's in the hands of the Persians. Turn to chapter 2 of the same book, Esther 2:8. So it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together in Shushan the palace to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house to the custody of Hegai, the keeper of the women. So notice, it was at Shushan the palace where the beauty contest was going to be held, and eventually Esther was brought into to prepare herself in order to stand before the king and to see whether or not the king was going to choose her as his future bride. Now turn to Nehemiah chapter 1. One book before Esther. Now remember your timeline. The events of the book of Esther occurred or will occur before Nehemiah. Okay? Before Nehemiah, and during the time of the last half of the book of Ezra. Because there's a marked shift in Persia's treatment of the Jews. In the early beginnings of Ezra, when the first migration goes, the Persian Empire was easily persuaded on numerous occasions to stop the work of the walls and to stop the work of the temple, until search was made in the archives that a Persian king did give them permission to rebuild both wall, city, and temple. In Esther, you will find in the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah is given basically an open check by the Persian king. He can get whatever he needs. Everybody on the other side of his travels literally had to open their doors to Nehemiah, and whatever he requested, they had to give it to him and it was bought and paid for on the Persian budget. Big difference. Well, why is there a shift in Persia's treatment of the Jews? Well, that's where you put Esther and her events, her and Mordecai, and how the fact that the Jews were able to defend themselves, and Mordecai became great in the eyes of the Persians. But look at Nehemiah chapter 1:1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, it came to pass in the month Chishlu, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan the palace. So notice, you have Shushan the palace, or Susa, S-U-S-A, this royal palace, this royal edifice, this royal building, was used by the Babylonians. And here I'm showing you that it was used in the time of Esther, and it was also used in the time of Nehemiah. And Nehemiah would follow the events of the book of Esther. All right? Now, go back to Daniel 8:2. It mentions the river Eulay. For those of you taking notes, this particular river is located 200 miles east of the city of Babylon. 200 miles east. East. The next thing we're told, that all of this happens or occurs in the province or in the county of Elam. Elam. Turn to Acts 2. Hold your place. Notice when all the different nationalities are mentioned where Jews came from to worship on the day of Pentecost, notice what is mentioned in verse 9. Acts 2:9. Parthians, Medes, so that ethnic group was still accounted for in the first century, even though they can be traced hundreds of years before the incarnation. Get that? And notice what's next. Elamites. Dwellers of Mesopotamia. So the Parthians, the Medes, and the Elamites would correspond to modern-day Iran, Iraq, or ancient Persia. Mesopotamia, dead center between Iran and Iraq. And then you have Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia. That would be the modern country of Turkey, or back yonder, Asia Minor. But notice, Elamites are mentioned. But where were they mentioned the first time? Where in the world could they have been mentioned the first time? Hold your place in Daniel 8 and go all the way to Genesis 10, the Table of Nations. Now, I'm pretty sure no one today can find Elamites. But all the assimilation and the wars and the migration of people. But there were Elamites still around when you came around 30 AD. Well, where did they originate from? Well, look at Genesis 10 in verse 21 and following. Unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Jephthah, the elder, even to him were children born. The children of Shem, front and center, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, Aram. So guess what? Elamites would be closely related to the Israelites because they're all Shemites. They all stem from the patriarch Shem. Okay, let's now return back to Daniel 8. Okay, beginning now in verses 3 all the way through verses 12. We're going to have this vision that's given to Daniel, and there are two key players to this vision. The first one is a ram with two horns. One horn is longer than the other, which comes after the shorter horn. So there seems to be one of the two horns, the longer horn that comes up later, seems to be a horn that represents a certain people that seem to gain the ascendancy over the other horn that remains a certain size but doesn't grow. And again, if you look at this board as you compare, you should be able to make your own connection who we're talking about here. Now remember, in an apocalyptic language, and when something is used in a symbolic nature, horns always symbolize power, might, rulership, or a king. Every time you see horn mentioned in a figurative speech, it represents power, authority, might, kingship, and one who rules. Now notice in verses 4, I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. So Daniel sees this two-horned ram pushing. Okay, the Hebrew word, for those of you taking notes, the Hebrew word for pushing means to thrust, or to go to war, or to gore, G-O-R-E, like a bull with his whore, goring someone. That's what it means for this particular ram to be pushing. And notice the three major directions. He pushes to the west. He pushes northward. And he pushes southward. Okay? So this individual animal here is pushing southward. So he's originating from a location. He's somewhere up here, if you will. And he pushes south. He pushes north. And then he would push to his corresponding west. So we see here a warring empire that chooses to gobble up both land and peoples at the same time. We're also told in verses 4, look at verses 4, I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. So notice, no one can stand before this animal. This particular empire, these particular kings that represent this empire. So he has a warlike expansion. Whoever this kingdom is, whatever it represents, it's in a war-eating mentality. It's going to pursue other lands, other peoples, conquering, killing, and maiming. Now, notice this. He has a firm determination. It is said of him, he will do according to his will. Now turn to Daniel 11 and notice what we find in Daniel 11. And look at verses 2. Now this ought to give it away. If you're really paying attention tonight, this ought to give it away who the ram is. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he will stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Now the king that's mentioned in verses 3 is not the same king mentioned here. This is a different king for a different lesson. But notice how these two kings, in order to be a king and to survive as a king, like a King Herod, you have to exert your will in a very predetermined thrust. If you just sat on the throne and looked out the window all day, you might not last on your seat, on your chair. In order to keep power, and in order to expand your power, you have to have a very determinate, firm, aggressive will and a desire to conquer both land and people. Now, same chapter 11, drop down to verse 16. Notice what's said about this king. But he cometh against him, but he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will. Now verse 16 is a whole different king than the one mentioned in 11:3, and much different than the one who's mentioned here in Daniel 8. But notice, we have three kings mentioned in Daniel, and one thing that's said about all three of these kings is they had a real, stubborn, strong, determinate, forceful will to do their pleasure. Conquering and subduing other people. Now drop down to verse 36, same chapter. Now if you're a futurist, you're now describing the Antichrist. If you're not a futurist, then you're looking at King Herod, as I brought forth in that nativity series about King Herod. And the king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself, magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. I believe this describes from this point on King Herod, who will then bring you right into the days of Jesus Christ's first advent, or his incarnation as God-man. But notice, I'm giving you four different kings. And notice what is said about all four of them. Strong-willed, will of great determination, no one and nothing's going to stand in their way. They're going to bulldoze anyone or anything that stands in their way for them to execute their heart's desire as a monarch. There's no wall big enough that he doesn't conceive that he can tear down. All right? Now, I don't want you to answer me, but do you have any idea who you think we're talking about here in chapter 8? The ram and then the he-goat? If you look at that chart, you should be able to connect the dots, who's who in the zoo. Now, go back to Daniel 8 and 5. And as I was considering, behold, a male goat or a he-goat came from the west. Now notice, if you think you've identified the ram, all you got to do is look at the empire that ram, you think who the ram is, you look at a map, and all you got to do is look to the left, and you say, I do know that the next king was going to come from this country, and he was going to go east, conquering everything in this pathway, and you would be right on target. Notice, and as I considered, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the earth, touched not the ground. Notice, he didn't even touch the ground. He just simply flew like a jet. And this goat, he had only one notable horn. So when it says he-goat, we're talking about a boy, a male goat with one very predominant horn. He comes from the west, meaning he's located west from the geographical point of the ram. He's to the left. He moves fast. He doesn't even touch the ground. He doesn't even land. He just simply goes. Like a plane that never even took off the runway, he just springboards. He moves so fast he doesn't even touch the ground. He had one lone notable horn between his eyes. And then look at 6. He comes to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing before the river Ule, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. So notice this he-goat is ticked. He is ticked. He is full of fury. And he's going to undo the ram. He has his bullseye on the ram. And he's going to bring down the ram. He has a strong, determinant will to do one thing when he conquers east. For him to conquer the east, he has to first subdue the ram before he can take over anybody else. Okay? He desires what the ram has. Now, verse 7. I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him. He was just simply exasperated. He was simply fuming. He was basically smoke out of his nostrils, and smote the ram, broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, meaning that eventually this ram would have no power of itself to maintain any campaigning against this he-goat. And there was none that could deliver him. He could turn to no other ally. There was no other empire on the face of the earth at that time that could come to his aid. He was all alone. And it says here that the he-goat stomped the ram. Now go back to chapter 7 and look at verses 7 and 19. Notice what is said of the Roman Empire, the ancient Romans, verse 7. After this I saw a vision, and behold, the fourth beast, dreadful, terrible, strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth. It devoured in broken pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. Notice, ancient Rome is said. When Rome is being described, it stomps everything into the ground. Now, same book, same chapter, drop down to verse 19. as it describes ancient Rome, then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were as of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with his feet. So the he-goat is going to be like the ancient Romans in the sense that when he springs out of wherever he originates from, he's going to pound everything into the ground that he takes over. But again, he cannot take over and achieve what he's going to achieve. He has to eliminate the Persians because they were a big chunk of real estate and he had to bring them down. Now look at verse 8, chapter 8. Excuse me. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, meaning when he had reached the ends of the known world, as we shall see, the great horn was broken. So again, in whenever I make my assertion, or when I state my understanding, that these are four empires, chapter 2 with the four, chapter 7 with the four. We know that 2 and 7 parallel each other. Daniel 8, hopefully you can see, homes in on 2 of the four. That these are empires that come one after the other. Again, there's no hundreds or thousands of years of time between them. They come in succession, all the way from 600 years before the birth of Christ, going right into the first century of the events of Jesus, the Messiah, the Passion, the Burial, the Resurrection, and then the Book of Acts, and the church launching out of its little nest, if you will. However, when the he-goat would reach the height of its power in its expansion, its horn, representing its might and its power, would be broken. This one horn would then, in turn, become four. Look at verse 8. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, for it came up for it came up four notable ones. Notable ones what? Horns. The context here is horns. So one horn is going to become four towards the four winds of heaven. Okay. Verse 9. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great towards the south, towards the east, and towards the pleasant land. Now notice here in those directions, he moves to the south, he moves to the east, and then to the pleasant land. Whoever this little horn is has to be geographically located north of the pleasant land. And that's going to give away who the little horn actually is. All right, in closing, this first lesson, this first installment, listen to these five considerations. Number one, the third beast, this he-goat, would be a contemporary of the ram who had the two horns. So again, where's the gap of time? While the ram is out there doing its thing, one horn being bigger than the other and coming up last, out of the clear blue from the west comes the he-goat. Again, my assertion, these empires are not divided by periods of endless time. X equals time. While the ram is doing its thing, when the ram thinks that it's comfortable, from the west comes this he-goat, and he doesn't even touch the ground. And he breaks and he subdues this ram, till the ram is no more. And then the ram, and then the he-goat then, when he, or it, comes to an end, no X equals unknown time, his empire, or it, is divided automatically into four, and you go right into the little horn. There cannot be a gap between the he-goat and whoever the little horn, because the little horn originates from the third beast. Okay? Are you following? That horn, that little horn, comes out of that he-goat. So how in the world could it be the Antichrist ruling over a revived Roman Empire when it's coming out of the third beast? Because when the third beast is all gone, then you have the fourth beast representing ancient Rome. But that little horn of Daniel 7 was Vespasian. If you keep that timeline in your mind, I feel you won't get confused. You won't get confused. Secondly, the goat replacing the ram in the normal flow of linear time. The he-goat simply replaces the ram in the course of time. As one empire falls, another empire replaces it. Thirdly, do these two respective powers show up elsewhere in the book of Daniel's prophetic book? And I think if you're smart enough and you look at the board that I purposely put up there, you should be able to, by simple reasoning and simple deduction from what you already know, who the ram ought to be, and you know who the he-goat is, since his empire is broken up into four, the question is, what happens to this leopard with the four wings? Maybe it's talking about that same empire. Fourthly, God is directly involved in the other nations on the earth. He's not only was he interested in Israel, ethnic Israel at the time, it seems that God also had concerns about the other nations. Did he not send Jonah to the city of Nineveh, that wicked city, and wanted them to repent lest he destroy them in 40 days? If God was only looking at Israel, just let the Ninevites go up in smoke. Let the 40 days expire and then take them off the face of the map. God gave them time to repent. He gave them time to repent. And then fifth and finally, do these two empires have any direct impacts upon Daniel's people? While we do know, if you're able to identify who the ram is, you know that it was under this particular empire that certain favorable things did happen for the Jews. And then when you consider the he-goat, that empire gave a certain contribution that eventually would find its way into the New Testament. And so my assertion and my position is that these are four empires that would come and go. They are no longer here. But they would have a direct bearing on God's people. And I'll go one step further. These four empires would eventually pave the way historically for the coming of the Messiah. Everything would terminate in Bethlehem stable and at the cross. All because of what these four empires... And again, these are Gentiles. Gentiles. These are pagan nations. This is not Israelite tribes doing this. These are uncircumcised, polytheistic, pagan people, and God is using them to bring into being the coming of the Messiah, right down to the exact day on the calendar.